All right, my name is Chris Bell, and today's date is the 13th of, Friday the 13th of May, 1983, and I'm at the home of Brigadier General John Adam, out in Oak Bay. And last day, we were talking about Hamilton Gault, and we actually ended with a little bit about Dieppe, but that's getting slightly ahead of ourselves.
Yeah.
You were with Gault for about 2 months in early 1942, I guess from about January to March, thereabouts.
You're right, yeah.
Okay, what happened to you then? Where were you assigned?
Well, then I was assigned to 1st Canadian Division under General Perks,
mm-hmm.
as DAQMG. That's the provisioning side,
mm-hmm.
supply side of the, and you're responsible for the functioning of the Army Service Corps, REME, Ordnance, and you know, all those that provide for the maintenance of the division.
Mm-hmm. Can I just interject here for a sec? I was reading through an official history last night, and I was surprised to find that of all our divisions in Europe during the war, a great proportion of the behind-the-lines troops, the quartermastering, whatnot, were British. Did you find that to be so?
Well, yes, because, you see, we were in Italy. We were part of 8th Army.
Mm-hmm.
So except for what we had from just divisional troops, the rest were British.
Yeah.
You see, they had quite a problem too, because they had to supply the Indians.
Mm-hmm.
And the Indians required special rationing. They had to take their sheep on hoof.
Mm-hmm.
And the killing had to be done by...
Right there
at the time. Yeah. It had to be fresh mutton. It was quite a problem.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
But did you find this as well in Britain when you were stationed there during training, that you had a lot of British troops assigned?
Oh, yes. Well, you see, we drew our rations from British establishments,
mm-hmm.
and we were maintained. All the army support was British,
mm-hmm.
and we were under, for instance, when we were in southern England, we were under Southeastern Command, and at one time, Monty was there as Commander Seco.
Mm-hmm. That was about 19, early part of 42, wasn't it? Right,
that's
through
right.
The period.
Sure, that's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
Until he went out to North Africa.
And made his name, so to speak.
That's right.
Pardon me, you continue.
Yes, I was under General Perks from March 42 until September of that year.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was transferred to 3rd Canadian Division, as DAAG,
mm-hmm.
and I was 3rd Canadian Division from September 42 until July 43.
When you actually went to Italy, I suppose.
That's when before I went to Italy, I was transferred then from July 43 to DAAG, 1st Canadian Corps.
Mm-hmm.
So I went up one formation, I went up to Corps, and there I was under General Creerar. And I was at Corps from July 43 until March 44. I went out to Italy with them,
mm-hmm.
Sicily. And
Sicily first, then on to
that's
Italy.
Right.
Yeah. Well, tell me about, before we get too far ahead of ourselves, about being under Perks. Did you know him, work with him closely, or?
Oh, yes, because at times when the AA and QMG, they'd take leave and they'd go off on courses and so on.
And the responsibility would be yours.
Yes, and I would move up to his headquarters,
mm-hmm.
and act as AA and QMG, and that's when I had very close. Well, I see the AA and QMG is the divisional commander's left bower.
Mm-hmm.
His GSO1 is his right bower, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So that he works through his GSO1 for his staffs, for his general staff side for the fighting.
The strictly military side of it.
Yeah, yeah, and then the AA and QMG is responsible for the provisioning,
mm-hmm.
and the general welfare of the troops. So, yes.
Had you known him before? Because this was...
Oh, my, yes. Oh, well, you see, when he was out here, he was the GSO1 in MD-11,
mm-hmm.
here in Squamaw. And when I was taking my courses, I saw quite a bit of George Perks then.
Would he tutor you in the...
Pardon?
Would he tutor you? Or would he...
Well, he, yes, and when we took the militia staff course in 1934, he was the boss man. He was in charge of the militia staff course mm-hmm. as a full colonel. And I took the course, and he gave us, or there were only three of us taking it, but we had very personal lectures mm-hmm. by him and other members of the training staff down at Work Point. And then we went to Sarcee, and we took our ride, as they called it, at Sarcee.
Mm-hmm.
And we did exercises, chutes. You know what a chute is?
No, I don't.
Well, it's a tactical exercise without troops. That's why it's called a chute. And a T-O-E-T, that's a test of elementary training.
Mm-hmm.
So you did T-O-E-Ts and you did chutes. I don't know if they still use those expressions today either. And then after you did your chute, you'd have the Americans called it a critique.
Mm-hmm.
But we had what they had, we used to call it the DS solution. And DS was the directing staff. And you'd make your summation of the exercise, and then they would criticize it,
mm-hmm.
tell you where you went wrong.
Well, how did you find him in the 1930s? As an officer and a person.
Perks, he was a very, very fine person. I liked him very much, but he was a bit stiff.
That's what I've heard.
He was a bit unbending.
Very British, too.
Oh,
I've heard.
Very much so. Yes. Yes.
So far as I've heard, one man I was talking to last week, and I won't mention his name,
no.
felt that he went too far and that he did it. It was sort of forced, this Britishness.
Yes.
Because
yes.
he was trying to maintain his officer and VC status.
That's right. Yes. He was. Actually, he was quite vain,
mm-hmm.
but he was a personable individual. You could talk to him. There's some commanders that I served under I found it difficult to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, the Corps commander, General Prior, he was difficult to talk to. And another one, the first Canadian Corps commander in the Hitler line, General Burns,
mm-hmm.
He was very difficult to talk to. You had to carry the conversation. He
mm-hmm.
practically just said yes and no. And you felt somewhat ill at ease in his presence.
Mm-hmm.
That's
not a bad stance to take, though, because he's sort of grilling you, so to speak, and he's trying
yes,
to bring it out
but,
from you.
Yes, but you have the feeling that he's sort of off in the distance. You know, he's not with you. He's sort of, you're having to bounce things off him
mm-hmm.
to get any opinion from him. Yes, I enjoyed the time I was under General Perks.
I imagine it was a period of intense training because there was the hope and the expectation of something to occur in the next.
Yes, well, we did an exercise. I think it was called Exercise Beaver.
That sounds like a Canadian name.
And we were a force that had landed on the beaches south of down at the in around. Worthing,
mm-hmm.
and we had established a beachhead, and we were to break out of the beachhead and invest Horsham, and we did this, and it was to be a 4 or 5 day exercise.
And this was with full divisional strength?
Oh yes, oh yeah, full divisional strength. So when we started off, Perks just got everybody he could. Troops, he caught them sitting on field guns, straddling field guns. Any way he could move them, he moved them so fast that we were in Horsham. And he signaled to Monty, who was the umpire in chief, that we'd taken Horsham.
Mm-hmm.
And Monty was very annoyed. So he told us to stay where we were, and he was coming to see General Perks
mm-hmm.
because. This was to be a 3 day exercise, and we finished it by noon hour the first day. So, sort of upset his plans a bit. He was very annoyed. And he came, we were in the headquarters was in a little place called Slinfold, just in the bush near this little village of Slinfold. And General Perks called all his commanding officers, each commanding officer of each battalion.
Mm-hmm.
for this O group to hear what Monty had to say. And apparently he and Monty had quite an argument before they came to meet at the O group. And Perks had an ADC by the name of Dick Danby.
Mm-hmm.
So along they came. We were sort of all standing around, and he came in. Perks' remark to the officers was, I refuse to be heckled, even by Army commanders.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that didn't do Perks too much good, because he lost his command and he went back to Canada.
Did he lose it while you were there?
Yes, yeah.
What was the talk at the time? Was it because of an incident like this? Was it politics? Was it his age?
No, it was just the fact that I think Monty felt that Perks had insulted him in front of the officers of 1st Division.
Really? In this O group?
Yes. And it wasn't long before Perks was back in Canada and had a new divisional commander.
Yeah. How did the officers react to this, you and the others?
Well, we were just dumbfounded.
Mm-hmm.
That he'd come out and make such a strong statement. But we were dumbfounded. We thought, well, my God, he's got lots of guts. That was the general reaction. So,
Well, how did you feel about Montgomery? Did you respect the man? Because here you have a BC winner, First War.
Yeah.
You sort of grew up with him in Victoria.
That's right, yeah.
And then you have Montgomery, who had a distinguished war record, to be sure, but wasn't as distinguished as Perks. Did you respect the man at the time?
He lost the respect of the Canadians, I think, because we had an exercise called Spartan.
Mm-hmm.
Or no, I think it was one earlier, it was called Tiger. And he called all the Canadians, after the exercise, or before the exercise, I can't remember which, in a place, a little theater in East Grinstead.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all sitting in there waiting for him. And he finally came out onto the stage, and he said, I will give you 5 minutes to stop your coughing, and then we will start the conference. And no, there was no smoking either. Mm-hmm. In his presence.
He was a non-smoker, wasn't he?
Yes, yeah, so he was a non-drinker. He was a non-everything.
Well, he was married, so...
Well, I met him. I was up on his headquarters for... what do you call it? Cook's tour, so to speak. I was up there to learn the British procedure.
Mm-hmm.
At Army headquarters. And I was there for about 10 days. And he was very seclusive.
Mm-hmm.
And kept him to himself. You didn't see him.
Mm-hmm.
Either just a couple of times when he was coming into the headquarters or going out of them.
Was he as distant as, say, Burns would?
Oh, he was more distant than Burns or even Perks.
Was it a natural sort of thing, or was it put upon by him?
I don't know. I have a feeling it was.
Yeah.
That he was up here.
It was his idea that being the rank he was, he had to be aware.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, of course, that does happen. Now, I found in my own experience that the higher up the ladder I went, the more lonely I became.
Mm-hmm.
Because individuals who have been your friends and your intimates, they tend to look upon you as, oh, he's up there now, he doesn't want to
associate
with us.
Yeah.
That's what I found. And when I was commanding in 1955 to 60, when I was commanding 25 militia group,
mm-hmm.
the people didn't come to you unless they had something they wanted to discuss. There was no sort of
social interaction as the rank.
That's right. Especially in your office.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the penalties you pay.
Right.
Is you are sort of divorced from the general camaraderie of the... And that's why I liked and I wanted to get back to the regiment. 3 times I tried to get back to the regiment.
Did you try under Perks?
Hmm?
Did you ask Perks if you
No,
get back?
No. I felt I'd had enough staff work. This would be in 19... I tried in 40, early 43, And then just before we went out to Italy, I heard Grierar say that he felt that a staff officer should serve not more than 18 months on staff, and then we returned to his unit for at least 3 months, and then return to staff again, so he could go back and get the regimental spirit.
Sort of refresh his memory, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, you lose touch with, unless you're working with troops all the time, intimately, you lose that.
And it was during the period when things like battle drill were being introduced, which hadn't been there before,
right.
Techniques, new weapons.
That's right.
Could be a whole new world when he got back to it.
Yeah. I got into the administrative side, and I couldn't get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
There were so few Canadians trained in what you were doing that had an expertise at it. To have lost you would have meant retraining or just training someone from scratch.
Well, that's what Grierar said when I was paraded to him the last time. He said, I agree with you, Adam. He says, I'd like to say yes, you can go and have 3 months with your regiment. But he says, we don't have enough trained staff officers. And he said, he says, we've spent a lot of money in training you as a staff officer. And he says, we can't afford to let that go to waste.
Yeah.
So,
you know, with the whole scheme of things, you can understand why he felt that way and how he was thinking. But personally, it doesn't give you much satisfaction.
No, it doesn't. He said to him, what is it you want, Adam? Do you want action? And I said, yes, sir, I want action. And he says, you stay with Corps headquarters. And he said, I'm guaranteed that you'll be in action at least a year before your Canadian Scottish is. So that's the way it did turn out, too.
Did you go to Corps from Perk's division?
Yes. And then, after that, too, was the first time I was at Corps. No, I came to Corps, 1st Canadian Corps, from 3rd Division. I'd been EAAG at 3rd Division.
Was this sort of giving you the training, sort of stepping up the ladder, and in so doing you had to move from unit to unit?
No, I think what they did, they were training me to be an A and Q. So I got my DAAG training with 1st Division, and I got my DAAG training with Corps and 3rd Division. So when I went out to Italy, then I was just a short while with Corps, then I took over 1st Canadian Division as AA and QMG under Chris Volks. He was quite a character. He was a very, very fine fighting soldier. He was a good tactician. And when he was in battle, he was just as... That was the only thing that was on his mind. But when he came out to rest, my God, what a man.
Really?
Oh, he was the most restless person. And he was... Oh, yeah. He was a very fine person. A lot of people didn't like him. They felt he was rough. But he had a good heart.
Well, I've spoken to one fellow, you probably know him, Colonel Norman Pope.
Pope?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he think he was an intelligence officer working under Volks in the Italian campaign. And he said that he had a number of nicknames, of which Bulldog, I think, was one.
Who, Volks?
Yeah, Volks.
Yeah, he was known as Bulldog. He was known as the Warlord. And there was an Italian general, Graziano, who had a mustache very similar to Volks.
Yeah.
And a lot of them called him Graziano. And others of them called him Electric Whiskers. Because he had a freshy beard.
Yeah.
Not a beard, but a mustache. So they called him Electric Whiskers.
Okay, now how did you get involved in the Italian campaign? Now, if I remember correctly, you missed Sicily. Like, you were with Corps?
No, we went into Sicily with Corps. But the fighting was over then. And the troops had gone into the toe of Italy, across the Straits of Messina. And they, when we got and we just sort of, what would you say, we loggered in Sicily. And we got our Corps headquarters on a real war footing then. And we were sent up to the various divisions in 1st Canadian, we were under 8th Army, and I went up and was understudy to the A&Q of the 78th British Division to find out, get their, how they worked in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And then we didn't take over as a corps until about January 1944.
Mm-hmm.
That's when we became right involved in battle.
And this is when they finally brought together 1st Canadian Infantry and 5th Armored Division?
Yes.
Along with a tank brigade?
Yeah, the Army Tank Brigade, but they never actually fought with us. The Army Tank Brigade mm-hmm. fought with the British all the time. Bill Murphy was commanding the 1st Armored Brigade.
Mm-hmm.
And he was under British command practically the whole of his career, the whole time in Italy.
It's always surprising to me why there were two independent tank brigades anyway. Why couldn't they have been formed up into an armored division?
Well, I think they were to give extra support.
And support on a smaller level,
mm-hmm.
so they can be detached easily.
That's right. Yeah. They were probably the the largest formation they could have, because it had was really fast, but had fast mobility.
Mm-hmm. Without the cumbersome.
That's right. Without its great B echelon that has to move along with it.
Division.
Mm-hmm.
How did you find Sicily? Was it a barren wasteland, or were you was it in Italy after the invasion of Sicily and after it was captured? It was a period of relative calm after the initial bridgehead had been formed, wasn't it, or?
Oh, yes, yes, there was a, I think, I can't recall just when the fighting was over in Sicily, but we were there from October, I guess it was the end of October, until January, the middle of January in Sicily. I know I went up with the advance party of Corps, and I crossed the Straits of Messina on New Year's Day, 1944,
mm-hmm.
and... as I say, we were. This was the group going up to be indoctrinated
mm-hmm.
by the various divisions in 8th Army.
Was it heavy fighting at this time, or what, as I say, was it rather quiet on the front?
No, it was a frightful winter. It was the worst winter they'd had in 40 years in Italy. And it was cold and wet, mud, and the Italian mud is just like slime.
Yeah.
And once, if it dries, it just cakes right on your boots, and you go around with elevator heels and so on. it was not a comfortable winter at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't break up. Well, it did break on April the 7th, and the temperature then just moved. It just suddenly woke up one day, and the temperature was over 70.
Mm-hmm.
And it stayed over 70 until the, I guess it was October... the 26th, it was never less than 70, day and night.
Yeah.
And at times, the temperature got up to 110 in the shade. And it's just as debilitating to fight in that when it's hot as it is debilitating to fight when it's cold.
Mm-hmm. Well, coupled to that was the fact that you're not fighting in one place, you're having to move.
That's right.
And if you're infantry, that means marching. And in heat like that, that can really drain it out of you.
And it's worse when you're fighting.
Oh, much worse, yeah.
Because you're not just marching, you're running from foxhole to foxhole or shell hole to shell hole.
Mm-hmm. And suppose the Germans had changed their tactics somewhat in Italy from Sicily because they had more troops. And instead of sort of holding and moving back, they were actually holding a whole defensive line.
Well, there were two defensive lines that they moved back on.
Mm-hmm.
There was the Hitler line, or what they called the Gothic, the Hitler line, and then in the farther north, there was the Gothic line. And the Gothic line was the one on the, just to bar the entrance into Rome.
Mm-hmm.
No, the Gothic line was after that. Hitler line was for Rome, And the Gothic line was to stop us breaking into the Valley of the Po.
Mm-hmm. Which would have been a complete change. Yeah.
Yeah, the Gothic line was in September.
Of 44.
44, yeah.
Okay. Now, you were with the British unit for about 10 days, 2 weeks, you say?
2 weeks, yeah.
And you came back and formed up Corps headquarters.
That's right.
Okay. Well, how did you find... How can I phrase this? Your activities, what you had to do in that Corps framework, how were you able to accomplish it, being on a tactical level as you were? Was it more difficult? Did we able to do it really easily?
No, everybody rose to the occasion.
Mm-hmm.
And my job was just to go around and visit the various formations.
Mm-hmm.
During the day. There's a lot of paperwork to A and Q-ing. And you're desk bound.
Did you have a large staff?
I had, well, as an A and Q, I had a DAQMG.
Mm-hmm.
And a DAAG. And the attendant clerks. No, it wasn't a large staff.
But you could delegate enough of paperwork.
Oh yes, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
The things that I had to look after, that I thought it was my personal responsibility, was honors and awards,
mm-hmm.
like having to vet them. You'd go down and check with the battalion or a regiment concerned. And,
well, what sort of levels would it be for anything above, say, a military medal, or would you also handle it for officers with a military cross as well? Or?
Yes, yeah.
Or would you be doing...
Well, you just read it to make sure that the citation read well, you know.
I get you. So it had already been given, but you just went down to...
That's right, just checked it through, and I just checked... sometimes, if it was a DSO, if it was a... there are two types of DSO. There's a personal one,
mm-hmm.
and there's one that's a battalion award, that if a battalion does a particularly fine job, then the DSO is generally awarded to the commanding officer of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that type of thing, of course, you don't have to vet that.
Mm-hmm.
But the personal, like the MC and the DSO, that are given for personal bravery, those are the ones that just wanted to check and make sure that and what we do, just we go over the ground, just take a walk over the ground with some person who'd been an eyewitness of the particular act of bravery.
Yeah. Before going farther, were you a lieutenant colonel or were you a major at this point?
When I was AA and QMG, I was lieutenant colonel.
I thought so, yeah.
The DAAG and the DAQMG are majors.
Mm-hmm.
Um,
you were here in this position, or there in that position, for quite some period of time, weren't you? All the way up through Italy.
Well, no, because, you see, I was with Corps as DAAG from the time we went out,
mm-hmm.
until March. I think it was March.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right.
44, yeah. I thought it was here.
Yeah, 25 March, 44.
Yeah, and that's when I went up to...
First Div.
First Div, that's right. Yeah. And I stayed with First Div until December. I was through the the Hitler line with them and the Gothic line.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed with them just before Christmas. And then I got an order that I was to be posted to Britain, to London.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know what it was to be, but just the order came through to post me to London as a colonel, full colonel.
Yeah.
So I got to A echelon, that was down in Rome.
Mm-hmm.
When I got there, the man I reported to, he was a lieutenant colonel, and he was, I guess he was A and Q, 1 Esch, as we called it.
Mm-hmm.
That was the rear base echelon. And he said, "Oh, Jack," he says, "I've got some sad news for you." And I said, "What?" He says, "Well, we've got another wire through that you're to be held in the Mediterranean area and revert to the rank of lieutenant colonel." So here I was just before Christmas in Rome. Mm-hmm. And so he says, "You just stay here." He says, "I think something else had come through." So I waited. I was in Rome about 10 days. I had a fine time. Right over Christmas and New Year's. I attended some nice parties that the Roman high society tendered the Canadians. Very nice.
Let me ask you this right now before we move on. How did you find the Italians? Because they had been our enemy a few months earlier.
Well, I tell you, we couldn't find a fascist. Mm-hmm. These are the people we've been fighting, but we couldn't find any. And there were some that were, of course, Italy was an ally in World War I. Mm-hmm. And it was not uncommon to see an Italian officer wearing a DSO.
Really?
Yeah. British DSO.
And I'm sure if you looked hard enough, there would have been a few officers in our own service who had some
Italian awards.
Yeah. Because at Caporetto and places like that, there were a number of.
Yeah. That's right. But so just after the new year, a posting came through and it just said, "Well, post Adam to CMHQ and report to MS, that's the military secretary, on arrival." Mm-hmm. So I flew out of Italy just after Christmas. And
By way of Gibraltar?
No, we flew right over France.
Did you really?
Yeah.
What did you fly in?
Was
it British or American?
No, it was an Army transport.
Anson?
No, it was the workhorse of the Army.
Oh, a DC-3.
The Dakota.
Yeah.
Yeah, DC-3. And
a C-47, I suppose. What was they were talking about.
I guess so.
Yeah.
But we flew. West first, and then got sort of in a line over Marseille, and we were up about 30,000, and sitting in this unheated plane, and we had oxygen masks that we could take a whiff of oxygen whenever we felt we needed it.
But I suppose this was a priority route, wasn't it? I mean, they had to get you from point A to point
That's
B in
right.
a hurry.
Sure. So they flew, and we hit a storm just over the Vosges Mountains. And you could see this wall, this great wall, black wall, and we had to get up over it. And we circled around, making altitude up over this. I don't know what height we got to. And then finally we got up over this, and all we did was take a long glide, and we came down over the coast. I guess when we came in over the coast, we would be... about 4,000 or 5,000 feet, mm-hmm. and we landed at Northolt. And
is that just outside of London?
Yes, not too far. So I reported into MS from Colonel Fleury, and he said, "Well," he said, "this is sort of a muck up here." He said, "You were to have been, and you were. It was approved that you were to become a QMG." Mm-hmm. London, just full colonel. And but he said it was approved by national headquarters here, and it was approved in Ottawa. But he said we forgot to get the approval of the senior commandant officer, General Crerar. Uh-huh. And he says we've done this a couple of times, gone over his head. And he said he put his foot down this time and says no. He says I should have been consulted first.
So simply on hurt pride, you weren't
on allowed. Hurt pride, I was held down. And a chap by the name of, that was on the tip of my tongue, now it's gone anyway. But he came back from France and took over. Mm-hmm. So I just cooled my heels again in London for another 8 or 10 days. So he said, "Go and take some leave," and he said, "Just phone me every 24 hours and tell me where you are." Mm-hmm. So I headed up into Scotland and I did that. And finally he said, "Okay, come on back. We've got a job for you." So I was posted to Northwest Europe as A and Q of number one line of communication terminals, and that was at a place called Turnhout in Belgium. And I was only there about 2 weeks. And
What month are we talking about now?
February, I think.
February 45?
Yep. I'm pretty sure. Yep. February and March. I was only there about part of February and part of March.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as I arrived there, I got a call from the Brigade Q at Cor. His name was Lister.
Mm-hmm.
And so he says, the general wants to see you tomorrow morning at 10.
Mm-hmm.
So I got up there the next morning at 10 and saw Career R. And he said, Adam, he said, I want you to know why you didn't get the appointment in London. And here's the reason. Now, he said, there are two positions coming up that you can take immediately. He says, you can stay there at LSE Terminal as the boss man down there, as a full colonel.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can come up here and be my assistant military government officer.
As a full colonel again?
As a full colonel, yeah. And not his, no. The Assistant Military Government Officer, 1st Canadian Corps, that was Charles Fowkes, was
mm-hmm.
commanding. So he said, you go over to Corps and see Gilbride, who was the A and Q at Corps. And he said, he'll give you what information you need.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I went.
Was there any thought on your part of using your own false pride in saying no, because this man had... Did you believe what he was telling you?
Oh, yes, I believed what he was telling me.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Because you had had a run-in...
Oh, no, Pierre was... he was a straight, honest person. He was just so honest, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his integrity couldn't be impeached.
I don't know.
Impeached.
He sounds awfully aloof, though.
He was. As I say, that was another... He was a difficult man to talk to.
Yeah. But you could trust him enough.
Oh, yes, implicitly.
So we went and had a talk with Gilbride.
So I saw Gilbride, and he said, "Now look, we've got an ad hoc establishment for you," and he says, "You can have, there are 25 officers and 75 other ranks," and he says, "You can have your choice of any officer you want in Corps for this establishment."
Really?
Yeah.
You mean all operational units in Corps?
Yeah, anybody I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Except one." And I said, "Well, what's that?" He says, "Well," he says, "you have a staff officer one," and he says, "he's your 2IC.
Mm-hmm. He was just given to you, no choice. You took
it. I took this one. This is the one I had to take. I had no choice."
Mm-hmm.
So it was had turned out to be John Buchan,
mm-hmm.
Lord Tweezmere. And he and I got along fine. He and I had a lot of fun together. And then I chose a chap who had been my DAAG, 1st Canadian Division, by a chap named McNeary. So I made him my SO2. He was John was the operational side, and Neary was the administrative side.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to Neary, "You choose what you want, any officer in 1st Canadian Corps."
Mm-hmm.
And I said to John Buchan, "On your side, you choose anybody you want."
You were given that authority. That's amazing. It's amazing considering how operationally the Canadians were still pushing up and into Germany.
Yeah.
And in fact, this was the time of I guess it was past the...
Well, we had no difficulty. We got an engineer colonel, or lieutenant colonel, and we got the various types of people we needed. We needed ordnance, and we needed REME.
Mm-hmm.
And they just came out of thin air, and they were a great team.
Well, let me ask you this. Did you, because you were but a colonel, dealing with divisional heads and brigadier generals,
yeah.
and you were pulling men from their ranks, did you cause any trouble there or any?
None whatsoever. No, I didn't have one whimper or someone saying no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this. When you talked to Crerar and to Gilbride,
mm-hmm.
what did they tell you your responsibilities were?
Well, they told me that I was the ACMGO, that's the Assistant Military Government Officer for 1st Canadian Corps, mm-hmm. and that when we got settled and when the war was over, and we would move in and we'd take over, we had what they call military government detachments. Mm-hmm. We didn't have any Canadians. I had, when I took over, I had 6 or 8 British military detachments under me, and one went into The Hague. But there was Canadians amongst them, mm-hmm. this British
organizations.
Yeah. And one went into The Hague, another one went into Amsterdam, and they became almost like they were the liaison between the civilians and the army. And the chap who went into The Hague, he became the town major, or the town, in other words, the civilians went to him to if they're having difficulties.
Mm-hmm. Pardon me, I was just going to ask, what was the purpose there? Was it to allow the government to spring up again as it had been, or was it to influence the government in a particular direction?
Well, with both. The situation was different in Holland than it was in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
The Dutch civic administration was just, it was underground, and as soon as the war was over, they just liaised along with its town major.
Mm-hmm.
And inside of 2 or 3 weeks, the British military detachments had nothing to do, because the Dutch were great organizers,
mm-hmm.
and they had things in their own hands, back in their own hands, some of them in the first 3 weeks.
Right.
And by July the 17th, when 1st Canadian Corps was disbanded,
mm-hmm.
The Dutch government was civic and local, it was complete control.
And the soldiers weren't really interfering at all, they were helping them.
That's right.
Had Queen Wilhelmina come back yet?
Yes.
She was in Canada during the war, wasn't she?
No. Juliana was,
mm-hmm.
with her children. But I don't know where Wilhelmina was. I think Wilhelmina stayed right in Appledore.
Did she?
Yeah. I don't think the Germans gave her sort of a refuge, or whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think she, I'm quite sure, unless she was in, she maybe was in Britain.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you, but I know she was back quite early.
Yeah.
Because we had the victory parade in Amsterdam, and she took it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was not many days after cessation of hostilities.
Well, let me ask you something else about the resistance, the Dutch resistance. How did you find working with them, one? How do they want to get into government, two? And I've heard that oftentimes resistance groups were rather communist in their political bent.
Well, they were a lot of them quite communistic.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember in the parade, when the underground or resistance group paraded, when they saluted Wilhelmina, they saluted her with the communistic salute, the clenched fist, and the straight arm out.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the person I had contact with was the head of the underground. His name was Van Beek, Dirk Van Beek.
He was a titled.
No, that's just a name.
It isn't Vaughn as in...
No, he wasn't titled.
Mm-hmm.
And his headquarters in a little village called Laren. And that's where I contacted him on the 5th of May. The Germans had gone out of that area. They'd been backed up towards the Zuider Zee,
mm-hmm.
or the Isselmeer. And when Laren was free, then I made a contact with him, and we arranged to get food. The armistice wasn't until the 8th of May,
mm-hmm.
but we had food in Holland, in the occupied part, German occupied part, on the 5th of May.
Well, how did you manage this?
Well, the Germans, the underground, got the Germans away from this little, pushed them out of this little place called Achten,
mm-hmm.
and we brought in 100 lorries, Army Service Corps, 10-ton lorries,
mm-hmm.
with food, and we offloaded on the roadside, and the underground took over the
distribution.
No, they just took over the guarding of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also had 250 1500 weight trucks. They were under the Free French, and with Free French drivers. And we gave them places where they were to just drive right into the village and go to the local grocery store and put the food, arrange with the grocer, the merchant, to put the food in his grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Dutch people could come with their German ration cards, and with their German ration cards they could get food, British food, on German ration cards to feed the Dutch. That's the way it worked.
Delivered by French drivers.
Delivered by French drivers. It was quite the...
Well, how did the Germans take to all this? You say they were pushed away.
Hmm?
You mean, you said the Germans were pushed away.
Well,
forcibly, or... Like at gunpoint?
Well, the 49th British Division was under command of 1st Canadian Corps.
Mm-hmm.
Or 1st Canadian... It was under command of 1st Canadian...
Army, I guess.
No, Corps.
Mm-hmm.
They had come up and crossed the Isle, and they had got themselves into Utrecht by the 5th of May.
Mm-hmm.
So when the 8th of May came, all this food was stored was then in British held or Allied held territory.
Mm-hmm.
And so he established a great big food dump just on the border, on the big field outside of Utrecht. And these little these 250 1500 weights did the food distribution.
Mm-hmm.
And they were still doing it when Cord was disbanded on July the 17th.
From the same dump?
Mm-hmm.
Well, how long did you hold this appointment?
Pardon?
How long did you hold this appointment?
Well, it was from February 45 until July the 17th when Cord was disbanded.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and then when Amsterdam was free, my counterpart at 1st Canadian Army,
mm-hmm.
or I was under his command, it was Sir Gerald Templer. And Templer phoned me and says, I'd like to come in and see what Amsterdam's like. And this was the day it was liberated.
Mm-hmm.
So I took him into Amsterdam along with the Dutch liaison officer. So when we were coming into Amsterdam,